With that very quick visual tour, looking at my clock, I think we are about ready to begin. So I'm going to call our presenter up to the screen. So, Tom, I will encourage you to come on camera. And as we are getting ready for that, I'll also ask you once you get your camera on and I've situated your video, I will go ahead and ask you to start sharing your screen. So, Tom, I'm going to put your spotlight up as you begin sharing the screen with our live audience. And I wanted to introduce everyone to our speaker, Thomas Rubin, who is a scientist here in EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tanks. He has been here in Ouse, where he's concentrating on insurance and cleanup issues, and he started his career as an environmental engineer in 1981. Back in 1986, he joined EPA Ouse to help write federal UST regulations and to assist in state regulatory programs and state funds with the release prevention and corrective action issues. Since his first time with Ouse, he developed and managed several environmental insurance programs, redeveloped numerous contaminated properties, and helped tank owners and state underground storage tank cleanup funds recover costs from insurers, responsible parties, equipment manufacturers, and installation contractors. He has also participated in the development of numerous ASTM and UL standards and is currently chairing ASTM's Moving Sites to Closure Task Group. So, with that introduction, Tom, I want to thank you for being here. I can confirm we can see your slides. Just one last request, if you can click that hide button at the bottom middle on the little floater. Perfect. Your slides look great. I encourage you to unmute your mic and take it away from here, Tom. And let me see, Tom, if you need any assistance. I'm going to push a button and let's see if you get that pop up.
I'm unmuting. Thank
There
you.
we go.
Now I'm going to
Excellent.
share
And
again. Okay. Really, I'm going to get there.
you're doing
All right.
great.
Thank you, everyone, for joining today. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to this presentation. I'm a longtime listener to Clue-In, and I've really appreciated the Clue-In throughout my career. And this is my first time presenting on Clue-In. So I'm really honored to be here today as a presenter. The things I want to cover today, several topics. I'm going to give a little bit of technical background to how we got to the Moving Sites to Closure standard, and then talk about two EPA, I guess, position papers. The first one is a clarification on free product removal, which is in our reg, the federal reg, and then talk about our exposure threat assessment policy statement. Then we'll talk about the ASTM standard. And finally, want to talk a little bit at the end about implementation. And how we see that potentially going forward. This is our problem statement that we started with in the ASTM task group, and this is why I came back to EPA back in 2001. We have this is what 50,000 open underground storage tank release cases looks like, and every state's got some, and some have more than others, but we've had this persistent sort of very difficult to close storage tank releases. We've closed 500,000 releases in this program, which is truly astounding when you think about it. I mean, when I started in this program back in the late 80s, and we knew the mountain was very high, and we had no idea if we'd ever reach the top. We did reach that top. We've been working away at this. We've closed 500,000 sites so far, but we just have this 50,000 to go, which are a little bit have been proving a little difficult. So just before we get started, wanted to see if we could do a poll question, and sort of get a feel for where people are.
All right, so I'm going to pop back here on the screen and launch the poll. So everyone, you should see a pop-up window that is now appearing on the screen asking, in your experience, what is the most frequent reason that a petroleum ust releases cases essentially do not reach closure? And you'll be presented with options such as lack of funding, a non-responsive owner, no access to properties to perform site assessment, LNAPL in the monitoring wells above state standards, or groundwater contamination above state standards. So you're going to pick what you think is the most frequent reason and then click the circle to the left and then hit submit. I'm looking at it, and of the 450 or so of you here, almost 300 of you have voted. If you're participating as a team in a conference room sharing one entry, you'll have to fight it out amongst yourselves and come to consensus and just pick an answer. We quickly want to get a quick set of input from everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll out here. So if you haven't voted, now is your time. If you haven't and can't see it, you can always just send a message in through the Q&A if you'd like to respond in writing that way. Let me close the poll here out in 3, 2, 1, and share those results. So, Tom, while there is a distribution, it does look like about 40% of the audience, that was the most popular response, felt that groundwater contamination above state standards was the most frequent reason why a petroleum ust release case would not reach closure.
It's awesome. Should we go on?
By all means.
Okay. So let's just go back a little bit in time to back when I got into the business of underground storage tanks back in the 80s. Back at that time, we were dealing with very conservative, sort of worst case cleanup standards. And they were sort of universally applied. It wasn't very site specific. And if you couldn't dig it up or pump it out, it was going to stay in the ground. That we had very limited remedies, and we knew that biodegradation was taking place, but we really didn't know much about it. Through the 90s, we developed this source pathway receptor concept that you all are probably very familiar with. We developed methods for determining site-specific target cleanup levels. There was a blossoming of cleanup methods, lots of in situ methods, just a ton. We have an amazing array of cleanup technologies available to us now. And we developed through the 90s, we developed tests for biodegradation. Now, coming to today, current best practices, we're using a lot of screening distances. There's a lot of focus on stability, which we're going to talk about more in the presentation, and alternative endpoints, again, the subject of MYSTIC. In the remedial methods, a lot of the recent work has focused on recoverability and natural source zone depletion and ways to enhance natural biodegradation. For natural degradation, we now know that you can rely on biodegradation at every single site. The rate may differ from site to site and situation to situation, but we know that every single petroleum ust release site has biodegradation occurring at it. And we've gotten really good at calculating the rate of biodegradation at those sites. And I want to go now to our conceptual model. This is out of the standard, and I've kind of got a little cartoon to go with it. So if you have a UST release, it's going to have liquid petroleum go in the ground, and that NAPL will some will dissolve into the groundwater, some will evaporate into the soil vapor, and that soil vapor is coming off of both the NAPL and off of the dissolved phase of in the groundwater. And what we worry about are those fumes coming up into homes. We worry about people drinking that water through drinking water wells, the contaminated water. And we're worried about the idea is that eventually it's going to reach a daylight point. It's going to hit a river, a stream, a lake. And then it could affect the ecology in where it comes out and daylights. So this is when I got into this business back in the 80s. This was kind of the conceptual model in our heads. And is that really true? We We've done a lot of, there's been a lot of good science done. There's been a lot of experience gained through all the cleanups that we've conducted. And we now know that that's kind of like an overly conservative view of what happens underground with a petroleum release. Realistically, and what we see site after site is that the plume reaches a maximum length, and then it kind of stalls out. For the dissolve phase, what happens is the biodegradation that's happening at the leading edge of the plume is keeping up with the movement of groundwater and the dissolving of new contaminants into that groundwater. So it reaches a maximum length and stops there. And what happens in the vadose zone is the vapors come up and they degrade in the ground. Some, if it's in an anaerobic condition, they're degrading to methane. And if it's aerobic, they're degrading to CO2. And if you've got enough distance still, your methane will further degrade once it gets aerobic into carbon dioxide. So if you're monitoring, if your drinking water well is inside that zone, it's going to stay contaminated for a long time. If it's outside that zone, it's not going to get contaminated because it's past the maximum length of the plume. And over time, the degradation is going to make the plume shrink, and also it's going to make the it's going to reduce the contaminants in the LNAPL as well. So it's degrading from within, and it's degrading from the edges and making it smaller. Eventually, it's going to get small enough that we don't have to worry about it anymore. So just a few sciencey slides here. There's been a ton of work done. We call them plumathon studies, has been done examining these large databases that we have of sites and all the site monitoring results. And we have learned that there's a statistical distribution of length of plume, and every site reaches a maximum distance. We haven't been able to predict how far that maximum distance will be, but we know that every site does reach a maximum distance for each contaminant. You know, MTBE goes further typically than benzene, and the 50th percentile is a lot shorter than the 90th percentile. But we've proved this in numerous studies that there is a maximum that these sites reach. So knowing that, you know, that really kind of changes our conceptual model. Also, I wanted to show this slide again based on thousands of sites. This is sort of average. This is the average or the median. I'm sorry, it's the median concentration in the source area of of releases, and you can see that over time, the concentrations are going down of the constituents in that of that petroleum. And this kind of looks like a first order decay curve, but it's not totally smooth. It's got bumps, it's got ups and downs. Not every the different components of the gasoline or the diesel will degrade at different speeds, but eventually it's pretty clear that the plume will eventually reach a very low level. And then one more slide. This is kind of our new version of a conceptual model, and it's got the area of NAPL sort of at the center, and it's above and below the water table, and we've got groundwater moving and dissolving out some of the constituents, and we've got vapors coming off. And now we know like 70% of the losses from this plume or from this LNAPL area go through the vapor phase. The dissolve phase is a very small part of the total concentration or the total mass in underground. And we've done throughout history, we've looked at the dissolve phase with monitoring wells, and we now understand we're really only looking at sort of a shadow of the actual contamination that's underground. most of it's in the NAPL or volatilizing out into the atmosphere. The rate of degradation, there's a lot of, there's the ASTM has a whole standard on how to measure the rate of natural source zone depletion, and there are there's a lot of debate about it. It varies from site to site, varies by an analytic method that you use, but there's a lot of good work being done in that area now. So that's kind of what we know now as our sort of new generic conceptual model. Knowing that EPA a couple years ago, we decided to clarify the what is in our standard for free product removal. Under the federal standard, we have a sort of two stages of cleanup, and the first stage is automatic. Everyone has to do it. If you've got free product that's migrating into clean areas, you've got to mitigate that, remove it to the maximum extent practicable. And that's sort of the automatic. You don't need a regulator to tell you to do it. You just got to do it. And then the second stage of cleanup is you develop a corrective action plan, you assess the site fully, develop your corrective action plan, and figure out how you're going to protect human health and the environment. So for that first stage, the sort of the immediate response stage, that's when that's where we get this free product removal requirement. And we issued a clarification as a response to a questions that we received that says that the you need to address product or NAPL that's in the ground that's migrating. In other words, that's spreading laterally to clean areas. Since we wrote the standards back in the 80s, when we wrote the standards back in the 80s, the term was free product, and that was all we used. Now, in sort of more recent times, we've developed this LNAPL divided into three different categories: residual, mobile, and migrating. Migrating meaning it's spreading laterally because there's head pressure on that NAPL and it's moving, it's making the plume bigger, a bigger footprint. Mobile meaning that it's going up and down with the water table. It could accumulate into monitoring wells, and that's mobile, but you really can't recover it very easily. And then residual is it's bound up with the soil particles, and no matter what you do, it's going to kind of stay there, and it's just going to degrade in place, or you could maybe it'll evaporate. Some will evaporate off. So what we said in this clarification was, the first part of it, the automatic part of it, is really only focused on NAPL that's spreading laterally, that's migrating, and that you should address the residual and the mobile NAPL as part of your overall corrective action plan. And if it's if you can protect human health and the environment without it, without removing that LNAPL that's mobile or residual, then it can stay in place. And that's a big change. EPA never really said anything about it before. It's a big change for some of the states. They looked at that and said, well, that isn't how we address it. But this is what we, this is our interpretation of our rules, and this is what applies to our sites in Indian country. The other thing we've done recently is since the ASTM standard came out, since the MISTIC standard came out, EPA issued a policy statement or a that encourages our state programs to and our regional offices to look at their inventory of open releases. So some states have 100, some states have a couple thousand. Take a look at your open releases and assess them again on like a desktop review using modern science, using our latest techniques, and look at it knowing now what we know. Many of our sites have been in, been monitored for 20 years now, and so you've got all that additional knowledge that you had didn't have when you first set the cleanup goals at the very beginning of the corrective action. So we're asking our programs to re-examine open sites and take a look at them again. And then, when you're re-examining them, focus your resources on the high threat sites and close the low threat sites. As we've been doing this in Indian country, we have found that, what, 15 years ago when this site first started, we didn't address the vapor intrusion issue. Or nobody's actually sampled the drinking water well that's next door to the release site. Maybe we should go sample that well. So we've been finding exposure potential as we go back and review these sites and treat those as a higher threat and schedule them for additional investigation. We've also found a lot of sites that are low threat and are just open because there's maybe they haven't met their initial cleanup goal, or for various reasons. Maybe they still have measurable NAPL in the monitoring well. And if it's a low threat site, we're encouraging our programs to close those sites and focus their resources on the higher threat sites. We also in this paper suggest, because 50,000 is a lot of sites to review, we're suggesting make that review process open and transparent so that the owners and their consultants can participate in this, and they can also make these reviews and make a proposal to the regulator. And that's a lot simpler than the regulator doing the review themselves. And then also we said in this policy paper that you should consider looking at the ASTM moving sites to closure standard for a framework for how to do these assessments. There are other ways to do it. We're not saying that the ASTM method is the only way to do it, but we're saying it's a good and it's a sound standard. It's based on a lot of good science, and a lot of good thought went into it. So, what is a threat assessment? A lot of people use threat assessment and risk assessment interchangeably. We've tried to draw a distinction between them as we worked on the MYSTIC standard and as we worked on the policy statement. The way we've been looking at it, threat assessment is the first step to a risk assessment. And threat assessment is, do I have contaminants reaching or potentially reaching a receptor? And then risk assessment takes that information, goes one step further, and says, if it's going to reach the receptor, is the concentration of it or the amount of it, is that going to be is that going to cause sickness, disease, injury, destruction of ecosystem? So with threat assessment, there's really only three answers to are my receptors threatened? The first one is no. And if it's not threatened, then can I demonstrate that? Can I prove it to the public and to skeptics? Do I have the data to show that it's actually low threat? And if it is low threat, can I close the corrective action? And if it is a threat, do I have a remedy in place? Does the remedy need more work? Is it making adequate progress? And then all too often, what we're finding as we're doing these file reviews is we don't know if the receptors are threatened. And so the outcome of the threat assessment is, what data do I need to understand the current threat? So it'll identify those data gaps that we need to close so that we can complete that threat assessment. Benefits of threat assessment, I think this is probably well known in the industry to you all on this call, but recognizing, finding threats you didn't really recognize before, vapor intrusion, drinking water wells that could be contaminated, that's really important. We're finding that these threat assessments that we're doing them on sort of a checklist format. They turn out to be really good ways to communicate to the public and to communicate to the owners, and officials, tribal officials when we're doing our tribal sites. It's easier to understand sort of a narrative of what's getting impacted or not impacted than to hand them a table of numbers and to say, oh, these concentrations are good or these concentrations are bad. That tends to cause a lot of members of the public's eyes to glaze over. And knowing what's residual, what's at the sites, what threats are out there, that's really good for people planning, for people trying to redevelop properties, understanding those threats and how severe they are, how threatening they are, is really key to getting some of these abandoned properties redeveloped and put back into good use. And then also concentrating on your high threat sites and closing out your low threat sites, that's a much more efficient use of cleanup funds and for staff. So I just want to talk a little bit about this, about the Mystic Standard. It took a long time to develop. It is definitely the biggest standard I've ever worked on, the longest standard I've ever worked on. We had a 90-person task group. It was the biggest task group I've ever chaired. It was a little bit of a wild group. We met monthly and had a lot of really good arguments and discussions. We had about, I think, almost 20 people were writers of this of the standard, which is a really good contribution level. And but the everybody on the task group was really great about reviewing drafts and getting in comments and participating in the discussions. So we had we it was a really successful group. We published in May of 2025 after two rounds of balloting, and ASTM is a really good consensus process. And throughout that process, we did talk to our states and had a lot of comments and input from our state programs as well during that process. Now I want to just show you sort of the process, and I apologize for this chart being so busy, but this is kind of right out of the standard. So I'm just going to talk about the bigger blocks here. The standard starts out with the conceptual site model. You've got to have a conceptual site model that can help you make these decisions. And so we have a whole chapter on how to review the model, the conceptual site model. Do you have enough information? Is it sound? Or do you have data gaps in it? And so that's where you begin. Then we have a chapter on non-technical issues, things like access, getting access. A lot of our sites, the owners have disappeared, and so you've got a non-responsive owner. You run out of funding. You run out of staff. So we have we encourage people to classify their sites as to what non-technical issues are keeping them from making progress, because it's a lot easier to solve a problem when you know how big that problem is. So if you've got 100 sites that have access problems, that's a lot easier to figure out than you can get everyone motivated to solve that problem rather than dealing with them one at a time and having one each project manager struggle through that on their own. And then also we have in that chapter some of the solutions that states have come up with, sort of best practices from our states for overcoming those barriers. Then we have the sort of the more technical chapters of this. Are related to the alternative cleanup standards. So you may have started out with a cleanup goal that was based on groundwater as measured in this one well or these several wells. There may be other ways to look at that site to determine if it's a low threat. And we broke it into NAPL, groundwater, soil, and vapor intrusion. And then for each of those, we talk about different ways to that the user can look at the threat posed by the site. In these chapters, we also have some really good information on how to evaluate uncertainty, and also how do you do the interplay with institutional controls and engineering controls in terms of controlling pathways and receptors. So if you get to the point where you get through that, you've come up with some alternative closure standards you want to try and meet, you have to decide, do I want to propose closure or not? If you don't want to propose closure, maybe you don't meet the standard, or maybe you don't want to live with the maintenance that goes along with the engineering control, then we have a chapter on how to evaluate the remedy? Is it making adequate progress? Is it effective? And if it's not making adequate progress, how do you select the next remedy? So I have a chapter on that. And then we just have two very short sections at the end on what we think should be in a closure proposal, and then what should be in the implementation plan and the implementation of the closure. And those are really just sort of outlines, because that's going to depend very much on state by state, the regulatory process in that state. So that's the process. Does Mystic apply to all the sites? No. Mystic applies when you're sure the release is stopped, when there are no current impact to receptors. You're not closing a site if you've got, if people are drinking contaminated water, you're going to be still working that cleanup. You've got to have no migrating LNAPL. The LNAPL can be mobile, can be residual, but it can't be migrating. And then you've got to have a basic CSM. Those are sort of the table stakes to get into the Mystic standard. And then for every, just talking about what do you have to have in the CSM? The CSM is where we exercise as professionals the most judgment. But there are three questions that every CSM should answer in the way we put it in this standard anyway. Are there any receptors that are currently exposed? What's the potential for exposure to receptors, including sort of reasonably anticipated future receptors? And is there a potential for NAPL migration? Every CSM should address that. If the answers to any of the first three questions are yes, then the CSM should also address, are groundwater contaminants likely to migrate? And if you're going to do a remedy, what do you need to know about? You need to know about the soil, the characteristics, depending on the remedy that you're choosing, for the removal of NAPL, for the treatment of groundwater, all those things. There's a lot of subsurface information you need to design that or select the proper remedy. And then there's always the question of, how much information is enough? When is enough enough kind of question? And this comes up a lot because it's really easy to say, you know what, if I could probably be confident in my decision if I had three more monitoring wells or if I had five more monitoring wells. It's always easy to collect more information. But you really need to tie that additional information to, is it going to really alter my exposure assessment? Is it going to alter my corrective action decision? And so there's a balancing act, and this is where judgment comes in. So just for an example of alternative cleanup or closure standards, we listed five different ways that are supported by literature and scientific study of showing that LNAPL is not migrating. So we have these five different methods, and we've listed them in the standard. We think they're all sound, but you in your state, you may think that only three of them are sound or two of them are sound. That's up to the state to decide, but we think there are five different methods out there today that give reliable indications of stability. And then for groundwater, soil, and vapor intrusion, we broke the alternatives into distance screening methods, contaminant concentration methods, and mass flux discharge sort of modeling methods. And the distance screening methods, you're probably familiar with that. In the last 10, 15 years, we've done a lot with vapor intrusion screening distances. We think you can apply screening distances also to the distance from the leading edge of the plume to a groundwater receptor, say a drinking water well, if it's more than 300 feet or 500 feet from the leading edge of the dissolved phase plume, that drinking water well will not be expected to be exposed to those contaminants. The contaminant concentrations is somewhat like is references back to the Rebecca standard, and you can use a variety of methods that are like Rebecca at looking at those. And then the mass flux and discharge, there's been a lot of really great developments in using modeling to gain insight into sort of worst case scenarios or conservative looks at what's going on in the ground. But the modeling scenarios typically require a lot more data about the site, and generally get used on bigger, more complex sites. And our typical UST sites, it's usually the one of the first two methods to determine low threat. So, what are the what can state programs expect as major changes based on MYSTIC? If you adopt and embrace MYSTIC, how that is likely to change your program? The biggest thing is this idea of going back and assessing the current threats of your open releases. A lot of sites, we establish a cleanup goal 20 years ago, and we are still chasing that same cleanup goal, trying to get there. And what we're asking is to go back, take a step back, and say, so what do we know now today about the actual threat from that site? We think that MYSTIC is consistent with non-degradation goals. A lot of states, well, several states have non-degradation goals in statute or in regulation. And MYSTIC gets you there with this low threat idea, because what it says is you're eventually, the groundwater and the contaminants are going to degrade naturally over time. And eventually that site will reach the non-detect level or the MCL level, whatever level is your goal. It's just in the meantime, we want to make sure that no receptors are exposed. And if there are no receptors exposed, we can go ahead and close the cleanup and let the natural degradation take care of the rest of it on its own. In under the MYSTIC framework, it's a lot more about stability and less emphasis on concentrations. If the plume is not moving, it doesn't matter how much what the concentrations are within the plume, if as long as the receptors are far enough away from it that they're not going to be impacted. So you can get these sort of more descriptive closure proposals than a numeric closure proposal. And we have two methods of showing groundwater stability under MYSTIC. The first one, which has kind of been what everyone's used for many, many years, is to sort of do trending analysis of concentrations in monitoring wells or thicknesses of the napple. And GWSDAT's a great tool for doing that, and we recommend that as a really good way to look at and demonstrate stability. But we also offer the option of using groundwater plume retraction as a method. And the idea with plume retraction is you look past the leading edge of the contaminant plume, and if you're seeing degradation byproducts past the leading edge, that means that the plume has been there and is now retracting to its current state. So you can say, well, that plume is stable, and in fact, it's retracting. As I mentioned before, NAPL that's not migrating might be acceptable, but you have to determine if it's causing a contribution to making the groundwater plume grow. So that's a big change for many states that have they can't close sites because there's measurable LNAPL or in a monitoring well. And then also another big change is MYSTIC would say, it's useful to monitor the natural attenuation process till you've got a trend. But after once you've established that trend, you don't need to monitor anymore to make sure it's successful. You may need to monitor land use. You may need to monitor to make sure that no one's putting in a drinking water well in the contaminant zone. But monitored natural attenuation sites can end the monitoring part of the natural attenuation after you've shown the stability. And then this idea of reviewing the effectiveness of remediation. Many of our programs, once an owner has a corrective action plan, they are going to run that plan till the end of time or till they're out of money. And whether or not it's effective, and the regulator has sort of they have limited ability to go back in and say, hey, wait a minute, you've run the course with that remedy. Let's switch to another remedy going forward. So that's kind of the summary of Mystic, and that's very brief, I'd be happy to go into it more if you have specific questions. But I just want to spend a couple minutes to talk about implementation. We know that at EPA, we rarely, if ever, tell our states this is how you got to do it. We are offering training and assistance. We think Mystic is cool. We think the reassessing your open sites is a great idea, but it's up to the individual state to decide if they want to do it and how they want to do it. So we're focusing on training and assistance, and if states want to pick it up, that's great. We partnered with ASTM to develop the training, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And like I said, we're doing training and assistance, and also we're doing a lot of workshops. We're doing presentations like this. We're at conferences, raising awareness and talking to people about this process. So this is how we see potentially individual programs adopting Mystic. And this is just as we're getting started. If you talk to me next year, I'll have some probably a more detailed idea about how this works. But we've been beginning with like an awareness webinar or a workshop to sort of get staff, get management aware of what Mystic could do for their program. Then the program needs to decide what they want to change. Mystic is written in an a la carte menu. You can use some of this and some of that and ignore this other part. So you have to decide the scope of your change and how much you want to revise your guidelines. And meanwhile, we've been creating a generic 2-day training with ASTM. It should be ready in March. That's our hope anyway. And then once the state knows what they want to do with their how they want to what parts they want to adopt, we'll customize that training to fit the state program. The state can publish, then ASTM will invite in the consultants, the staff, and all the stakeholders in for a 2-day training, hold that training, and then everyone's off on the same page, starting with the revisions in the program, everyone on the same page. And then EPA will help with measuring effectiveness and revising the process in the state, helping the state see what maybe needs to change in their state. But also, we want to go back and revise the ASTM standard when we find things that are wrong in it or could be improved. Now, I put in this timeline for like as fast as we could go with a state that doesn't need to make hardly any changes to their guidance. We could go as fast as, getting to 90 days, 120 days, getting out there to getting the training done. And like I said, we've got this 2-day training almost ready to go. If the state has a lot of changes, like I'm working with Montana, they have to change their law. They've applied to the legislature. The legislature will meet next year. It's going to be a long time. In Montana, they're going to make some of the changes that they can make within their current authorities. And then once or if they get additional authority from their state legislature, they'll make some more changes. This could drag out for a couple years easily. It's not a simple process, but we think the flow of it is pretty similar in that it has followed the same path. It just takes longer, and there's more work making the for the state to make their changes. So that's what I had for my presentation, if you will have a little bit of time, I think, to have questions. And if you have any further questions, if we don't answer them today, you can always reach out to me. We have like this sort of 1 hour sort of webinar that we can do. We can do it in person. We have a 4 hour workshop that we've been doing, and we're doing that with a number of states in the next month or two. And like I said, we'll have this 2 day training available. So with
Oh.
that, I will turn it back over to Jean and we can answer questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom. So, just a gentle reminder to the live audience, you can continue to submit your questions on in using the Q&A window. And, Tom, I'll have you pull the slides back up because some of the questions relate back to them.
Okay.
Full disclosure, we've got about 10 minutes left and we may not be able to get through all of the questions, but I'm going to try to get through as much as I can and sort of group them together. A number of individuals have asked about a specific point, and I think there was a statement that you were making earlier, and I want to give you the opportunity to sort of clarify or repeat it regarding LNAPL. So there were a number of individuals who asked about leaving LNAPL in groundwater if there's a federal drinking water standard for it. So specifically, we have an individual who put in a really great statement. Boy, there's a bunch of them that just came in on this one. But essentially they're asking, there's a federal drinking water standard. How can we leave LNAPL in the groundwater?
The federal drinking water standards are measured at the tap or at the wellhead. There's a lot of sites, and in fact, the vast majority of our sites have some residual at them, so there is some groundwater under that site that is contaminated and does not meet the federal drinking water standards. Where the federal drinking water standards apply is at the wellhead or at the user interface. And so what we want to do is make sure that those petroleum contaminants do not get into that water supply. And
Right.
if for some reason there's an impact to a individual private well, that you've got to put carbon on that well if you can't get an alternative water supply in and protect that water supply. But
Okay.
those are both acceptable resolutions. And the contaminants end up staying in the ground in those situations.
Okay. And then we have some questions about degradation. So one of the participants wanted to know, does the standard include parameters for other compounds to confirm natural attenuation, like increasing daughter products or biological organisms? They'd like you to, in another question, discuss the role of microbial testing in moving to site closure. They're just trying to, they've been thinking specifically about this idea that they can rely on biodegradation at us sites. So they're wondering about the role of microbial testing into CSM development, corrective action evaluation.
So microbial testing used to be, we used it a lot to confirm that degradation was occurring. We now know that degradation occurs at every site. And microbial testing has now shifted for petroleum. I'm talking about petroleum products only here, has now shifted more into, is my remedy being effective? Is it stimulating enough microorganisms? So microbial testing is now used more in a is a remedial effectiveness measure than is degradation occurring or not. We've tested so many sites and not found a single site where degradation isn't occurring, at least at some level, that we now know you can rely on it at every site.
Okay. One of the big questions that a number of people are asking for is about states. And you mentioned some states might be willing to adopt, some states might not. So I have got questions, for example, has New Jersey shown any interest in this? I've got questions asking about Michigan. Someone else is asking, is there a public list of the states who are interested in or have adopted this? So can you talk a little bit about implementation from a state perspective?
We're just getting started, and a lot of states have expressed interest. New Jersey is one that has expressed interest. They're going to learn more about it, that we're going to do some training and have some discussions. I know that there's a lot of interest in the public and in amongst the owner community in New Jersey. Michigan is a state that is that has also expressed interest, but right now they're implementing one massive change that they have been developing over the last 3 years, and they'll probably be more interested in looking at Mystic next year. We've got so far, I think the last count I've got of people that have called and talked, and I'm kind of keeping tabs on them. We've got 6 states so far that have committed to adopting Mystic, and a lot more that have committed to, I want to learn more about it. And well, we're going to train them up over the next few years, next 2 years, to get them up to where they can decide what they want to adopt, how they want to adopt it.
Okay. I'm trying to group some of the questions here so we can get the most bang for our buck here in terms of time remaining. So another large chunk of questions are focusing on accessing the standard. So I'm seeing questions from EPA staff. If we help develop it, can EPA staff get to it for free? Then there's others asking, do you have to buy it? Or if is there a free version that they could get to? And then sort of are there templates and boilerplates and tools included in the standard if they do pay for it? What do they get with it?
Yeah, I'll answer the last one first. Yeah, there's several appendices of checklists
Okay.
that we develop for the standard that make it easy, at least as a starting point, for states to develop their own checklists. So there's lots of tools within the standard that are worth the price of admission alone. As far as for state regulators, ASTM has a free read-only version. You can contact Molly Lineck at ASTM, or contact me and I'll put you in touch with her, and she can get
Okay.
you a free read-only access. Many states and EPA already have free access to standards. I mean, EPA pays for it, but any EPA employee can access the standard for free, download it, and use it, in their work. If you have trouble learning how to do that, I can show you how to do it. So just contact me. But yeah, we at EPA, all of the employees have unlimited access to all the ASTM standards.
Okay. And then several people have asked about the 2-day trainings or the workshops. How do they find them? How do they access them? And is there a cost?
The way we're hoping to do the 2-day trainings is that the state will sponsor it once the state knows how they want to change their system, and ASTM will work with that state to develop the cost for them. And our deal with ASTM is that the owners and the consultants will pay, and the state regulators will join for free in that 2-day training. That's how we so far have set them up. I imagine over time we're going to end up with 2-day trainings that are not tied to any particular state program, but at least the way we're starting out is the 2-day trainings will be tied to individual states.
Okay. There are a number of what I would describe as more situation or site-specific application style questions, like in this case, at this type, do I need the following? And unfortunately, we simply don't have time to get into that, but we'll remind everyone on how they can follow up with Tom on more specific application style questions. But I do have a few people that have commented on trends or impacts that they're noticing. And there are some statements in here regarding perhaps the need for more environmental covenants. Specifically, it sounds like to some of the participants, a site that's closed with Mystic means, or to them, sounds like they're going to see an increase or need more institutional controls and environmental covenants. So contamination is left, but it's stable. Would you say that that's a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's a fair characterization. Not every site where contaminants are left behind needs environmental covenants or land use covenants, but that is definitely one way to do it. ASTM has several standards on that. ITRC has a great guide on it as well. EPA has a couple manuals on using engineering and institutional controls that are also quite good. So there's a lot of information out there. Anytime you leave contaminants behind, you need to consider them. They're not always needed, and if you're going to use them, you need to use them properly. There's nothing worse than a institutional control that isn't enforced and tracked. So yes, that definitely that is, and we have a whole chapter on that interplay. It's a very important consideration. If you're going to leave significant contaminants behind, you need to certainly consider the need for institutional or engineering controls.
Okay. All right. I do see we've got probably a two dozen or so more questions and simply not enough time. But I do want to remind the audience, right, that this is one of their very first possible touch points with you, Tom, and that there are other ways to follow up for more training, to ask more questions, to get access to information. So before I go through very quickly, final reminders, including certificates of participation, accessing the recorded version of today's session where you can get the slides and the links. I will cover all of that in just a moment. I wanted to offer Tom just a chance to share any final reminders before we close things out with our audience today.
Oh, just thanks for listening, and if you have questions, contact me. I'd be happy to engage and figure out what's best for your situation.
All right, so with that, I'm going to thank Tom so much for his time and willingness to share his expertise today. I'm going to take back control of the screen and walk the audience through just a few quick final reminders before we go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. So, as Tom noted, let me push back here. I'm going to go past this one. I will encourage everybody to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network. As well as sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which is how we advertise sessions. And as more resources and opportunities become available for Mystic, we will be happy to include those in future editions of Tech Direct. So if you're not a subscriber, I encourage you to visit us there and sign up. Our next edition will go out on the 1st of March. Remember, when we started today's session, we did develop a unique seminar homepage. The URL is shown in red on the slide. You can also access it with the QR code here. On that seminar homepage, we have already posted copies of the presentation materials, links to the standard, as well as links to a variety of other resources and websites on the topic. Some of you have asked if this session qualifies for CEUs or PDHs. And while I don't offer those types of credit hours, you may be able to earn them from your own accrediting institution. Oftentimes, the items that are required to give you credit, such as information about the speaker bios, the session descriptions, copies of the slides, all of that we have posted here on the seminar homepage. And if you fill out the online feedback form, we have a button to that right there on the seminar homepage. Once you fill out that online feedback form, at the bottom, there will be a button to certify you were here for the entire delivery. As soon as you click that box and submit your feedback, you'll then have immediate access to download or print out a certificate of participation, which has all the details on the session. If you happen to be sharing the room with a group of other individuals and they didn't register on their own, if you point them or send them to the seminar homepage, each person in that room can fill out the feedback form on their own and get their own certificate of participation for their own records, even though they didn't register individually. So, for those of you looking for credit hours, while I cannot issue the hours myself, you might have luck earning them with this type of documentation. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones watching the recorded version of today's webinar, yes, indeed, we did record today's session. In about 1 week, there'll be an automatic email to all registrants with a link to access and replay today's session. You're welcome to forward it on to other professionals that you think will find this a valuable expenditure of their time. And if you've made it to this point in the recording, you can still follow the link to the seminar homepage or scan the QR code shown on the slide and fill out the online feedback form, checking the box at the bottom, indicating you replayed the entire archive and get a certificate for your records based on watching the archive session. If you again have made it at this point in the archive, right about now in the upper right corner in the recorded version above my head, there will be a link to that seminar homepage. So you can head on over and give us feedback and get your own certificate of participation. So with that, I want to thank the nearly 500 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast, as well as the support team who helped me run today's session and our wonderful speaker, Tom Shrubin. I hope that you enjoyed yourself today and we will see you on a future Clouen seminar. With that, it is my pleasure to formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.